Good evening. It's Saturday, April 4th, 2020. Coming up, California Governor Gavin Newsom calls it a new day in California as the state makes coronavirus testing more widely available. In the midst of the global COVID-19 pandemic, there are increasing worries about election security. And Wisconsin is on track to move forward with its Tuesday primary elections in spite of Governor Tony Evers' attempt to cancel in-person voting due to public health concerns.
Wisconsin, unfortunately, is going to have to serve as a case study for the rest of the nation to keep watch on as we move forward in the primary cycle.
And as people around the world are being asked to shelter in place, many working class and poor communities are finding that that is easier said than done.
They are taking precautions, but at the same time, when it's the question of hunger versus the disease, hunger is, it is important to assuage as compared to the disease.
I'm Sharon Sabota, and this is the KPFA Weekend Evening News. In today's briefing, California Governor Gavin Newsom announced that 2,300 people are being hospitalized in the state with coronavirus, with 1,008 of them in intensive care unit beds. This is nearly an 11% rise since yesterday. So far, over 12,000 people have tested positive in the state of California. This represents a 12.4% daily increase. Newsom announced that so far, 126,700 Californians have been tested for coronavirus, and Newsom says that number is too low. He also shared that with the testing backlog, there were recently 59,500 people waiting for results, some for up to 12 days. Newsom said the testing backlog has been reduced to 13,000. He called the testing space a challenging issue for the state and said he wants to own that issue. He also announced a task force with the aim of increasing testing in the state fivefold in a partnership with UC Davis and UC San Diego to create up to 7 testing hubs throughout the state to help increase testing capacity. Newsom stopped short of giving numerical goals because he said he wants to make sure he can deliver what he promises. Election security in the United States was a concern even before the COVID-19 pandemic, and now the concerns are heightened. Wisconsin's primaries are slated to take place on Tuesday in spite of Governor Tony Evers' failed attempt to block in-person voting due to public health concerns in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic. Yael Bromberg, chief counsel for voting rights for the Andrew Goodman Foundation, says much is at stake in the state of Wisconsin. Bromberg says nuanced laws in Wisconsin, like the one that has effectively made it difficult for the state's 300,000 college students to vote using their student IDs, already deterred many eligible voters from participating in the election in pre-pandemic times. Now she says it's likely to get even more difficult. Bromberg says serious issues are at hand for Wisconsin elections.
The election is moving forward despite some serious voting rights issues. You know, not only is the voter ID requirement continued in place in terms of its accompaniment with the absentee ballot process, which at the Andrew Goodman Foundation, we have a serious issue with because the state has the strictest form of student voter identification in the country. But also there's a lot of issues and concerns around in-person voting, which will obviously lead to a public health crisis across the state, along with massive voter confusion around how people can cast valid ballots. And in addition, there's a massive lack of poll workers to fulfill the demand for in-person voting. For example, the city of Madison has approximately half of the poll worker shifts filled for Tuesday's election. The city of Racine, which is more ethnically diverse than other cities in Wisconsin, where about 20% of the residents live below the poverty level, they only have about 50 of 135 poll workers willing to work. And in Milwaukee, the same. They usually have about 1,400 election workers, but they're now down to only 350.
And in addition to people having to ultimately make a choice between protecting their health and casting a vote, which might deter some people from voting if they plan on voting in person, you were already addressing voter discrimination issues that were impacting what you call the youth voters, people who wanted to vote using a college identification. And now you're even more worried about this population because many of them are displaced.
So at the Andrew Goodman Foundation, our mission is to make youth voices and votes a powerful force in democracy. The Wisconsin legislature enacted a series of election restrictions in a short period of time. And with regard to young people specifically, the strict voter ID law requires that the IDs only be issued every 2 years in order to serve as a valid form of voter identification. That means that students that have been forced to temporarily relocate as a force of this crisis, they already had issues accessing that form of identification. For example, the first election in which that law was implemented, Wisconsin saw the second largest decline in the nation in terms of youth turnout. And those rates were on par for the 2018 election as well. So we already had this issue in place. Now with COVID, how are they going to get compliant voter identifications in time? They just aren't going to be able to. And there's also issues with regard to students that already had requests out for absentee ballots, for example, that they're going to be sent to their college addresses rather than to their temporarily relocated addresses, which is of great concern to us as well. The college mailing systems are just not functioning right now for obvious reasons. And when we have these tight deadlines, how will enough safeguards be put into place, for example, for forwarding systems to accompany the election deadlines? Really, what I want folks to take away from this as we kind of study what will invariably be calamity in Tuesday's election is how we can learn from this process. So right now, there are federal bills that are moving forward to standardize absentee voting options and to modernize election systems, and also to allocate enough federal funding in place so that the states can implement these remedies. And so Wisconsin, unfortunately, is going to have to serve as a case study for the rest of the nation to keep watch on as we move forward in the primary cycle. And importantly, we're going to have enough funding secured by the federal government to secure these systems in place. The last stimulus package, which included a drop in the bucket for election security, that money needs to be fully restored. The Democrats were successful in pushing for increased funding. The Republicans only wanted to allocate about $140 million, a little over than $400 million ended up being allocated. But election security experts are estimating that they'll actually need $2 billion. But when we look at the entire stimulus package that's being put into place, that comes out to only about the $2 billion number, which is what we need to aim for, only comes out to about 1% of the total stimulus package that was passed. So we were talking about a drop in the bucket, and the fact that we can't prioritize election security in this pandemic is something that we all need to be on watch for.
That's Yael Bromberg, Chief Counsel for Voting Rights for the Andrew Goodman Foundation. In early March, thousands of people gathered at a mosque in New Delhi, India, from around the country and around the world. The gathering was days before the World Health Organization declared the coronavirus outbreak a pandemic, which happened on March 11th, and weeks before India went on lockdown on March 24th. In India, at least 647 of the attendees have shown signs of COVID-19, and as a result, some Muslims in India are being targeted and blamed for the country's rising cases. India so far has nearly 2,600 recorded cases and 72 deaths. Charmaine Kenika is a writer based in Bangalore. She says that rather than playing the blame game, it's important that everyone does their part to flatten the COVID curve in India.
In the last couple of days, there was this congregation of Muslims in Delhi, and of them there are quite a number of cases who have tested positive, and that too after they've left that location and gone to other cities in India. So that has become quite the topic of contention, you know, on what exactly happened, why they have come up with this positive. But from the way I see it, there have also been cases come from people who traveled abroad and come back. So, I mean, if you see that way, then everybody is responsible for bringing it in, you know, and spreading it around.
What does the COVID-19 lockdown look like?
So in India, we are so used to crowds. Anywhere you go, everywhere you turn, there are just people. And I have seen over the past few days stepping out for groceries, it's just been empty roads, empty streets. A lot of it has had to be enforced because people were not taking it seriously. So the police have stepped in to ensure it's, you know, strictly followed and all of that. So there are fever clinics, there are, you know, to pick up the initial, what do you say, symptoms, and then the people, in case of any positive cases, they are filtered to another, you know, main, there is a government medical hospital. So off late, even private hospitals are being approved to take such patients.
And one thing we talk about in the United States when we talk about India is that social distancing, in a way, it's a privilege, and it's a privilege that not everybody in India gets to enjoy, especially yes. the people who might live in very humble circumstances. So in that way, what are your worries about the poor people in the way that they're able to care for themselves or really stay in place and still meet their needs of eating and this kind of thing when they're living kind of hand to mouth?
So there is this whole bunch of us who are living in our own bubbles. And then there is this other set of people who, by virtue of being, you know, economically poor, are put together. So invariably, they are going to pick up this sickness, and invariably it's going to be out there. They are taking precautions, but at the same time, when it's the question of hunger versus the disease, hunger is you know, more, it is important to assuage as compared to the disease. So I think for them that matters, that they won't be able to survive without food. They can survive with corona, but they cannot survive without food. So a lot of organizations are like lay people. Like, I'm a part of this group called Caremongers, which is, we are doing a lot of these runs, you know, delivering medicines and trying to gather food or make arrangements for food for people and all of that. So we are doing what we can, but they are forced together.
What is the government doing to care for people who might be in the lower socioeconomic class?
So the government has put out, you know, measures in terms of, you know, delivering a monthly ration and amounts and all of that thing. So a lot of people are covered for sure in this, you know, from the poor to widows to all of that. But there are always these little pockets of groups who slip through the cracks. For example, transgenders are not getting adequate, you know, monetary or other compensation. So where, again, lay people are stepping into. So I've seen a lot of people just opening up their purses and hearts and just giving money. You know, I personally have collected money in an hour. We collected quite an amount to pay up somebody's rent and 2 months, you know, groceries. So I'm just, the government is doing its bit, but it's not enough.
That was the voice of Charmaine Kenika, a writer based in Bangalore, India. The Qatari government announced that 3 billion riyals, the equivalent of $824 million, have been set aside to support companies in paying their employees. This is especially important for the country's migrant and expat working population, which has been the hardest hit by the COVID pandemic. Qatar so far has 781 confirmed coronavirus cases, the highest in the Arab Gulf state, and 2 deaths. Earlier this week, the Ministry of Administrative Development, Labor and Social Affairs announced that it was mandatory for employers and companies to follow the policy, saying that workers were put on quarantine as a precautionary measure to protect all. They also added a multilingual hotline for workers' grievances. Haifa Hussein is a Sudanese mother of 3, raising her children in Doha. She's also an employee of the University of Qatar in Doha. She says she has hope that the government's actions to contain the pandemic by having everyone shelter in place will make a difference.
We are staying at home for me because I'm working in the university, so I'm working from distance. So everything now for us is online because I'm in the student service. So while students are studying in their home, there is no point for us to be working from the university.
What are the rules for the people who live in Doha right now?
They are trying to give restriction for people, but it's more to be about the person itself. Like, you need to wash your hand, you need to keep distant, you need not to go out unless there is something important. They closed all the shopping malls. They shutting down all the grocery is open, pharmacy is open, but other services now are shutting down. For food, they have a delivery, like most of the food service and restaurant are closed now. It's like whatever, like the crowd, blessed that the crowd people, they are closing it now. People are not allowed to go to beach, to places where they parks, they already closed. All the public places are closed now.
So, of course, it's a Muslim country. There's many mosques and things like this. What does it look like for like Friday worship? How is that being handled while everybody's under lockdown?
There is no going to mosque now. It's been closed, all the mosques. And they are calling because we have five times they are calling for Adhan. So at the end of the calling, they are saying, stay in your home, which is, one of the way that when pandemic happened during Prophet time, they also were calling people to stay at home. So we are following the same. So now there is no people are going to mosque. There is no religious gathering. And now it's all forbidden. People supposed to be staying in their home until everything is settled down and everything has been sorted out.
Do people pray virtually? Here are some of the services that are being held like virtually on the internet. Are they doing that? Or is everybody just kind of doing it at home on their own?
Just at home. But there is, you know, about like Quran classes, stuff like that, they are doing it. You can have it virtually. But for the prayer itself, no, people are doing it in their home.
So what is the government doing to take care of the laborers who are living, like, I know that some of them didn't live in great conditions before and lived with many people. Is the government
tremendous job. There is also some videos that we already put for public. I could have shared for you later. They already wash all the industrial area, which is the most of the cases when it started. They literally washed it. They already a lot of police forces there they closed it, they shut it down, nobody entered, nobody went out for that area. The medical care, they already having a very good medical care there. Also, they are giving them a very good meals. So, and also for the meals, there is one of the labor, he already shared what they are giving for them. It's really a very strong job that they did there. There is a lot of videos that people share about whatever the country is doing now for people. For the citizen also now they are starting to give them, because citizens, they have like a card for foods, which is like, it's like a vouchers for them. They could have some of the milk, sugar, stuff like this. So now they are adding for them also some sanitizer and also some of the masks.
What is giving you hope? How do you, like, I don't know if the kids ever get sad or if they ever feel kind of trapped or isolated, and if for you too, what's giving you hope during this time?
Oh, yes, we're starting to know each other better, and which is really good. And for me, you know, with this activity we are trying to do with the kids, you know, I found out that I had a lot of stuff that I bought and we didn't have time to use. so now it is the time to use it. Also with this quarantine time and the other services that started, especially like delivering to home, the online, I found out I was just like wasting a lot of time just driving and buying stuff and going to, yeah, and now there is a lot of alternative we find out, which is ease our life and save a lot of time, and which is also at the end we will become more relaxed and less stressed. Alhamdulillah, it was for me, it was really good.
And for people in the rest of the world who might be struggling sometimes to find hope right now, or who need to help finding kind of the silver lining, what advice would you give to other people?
Just be positive, not to be exposed to social media too much. And because there is a lot of, everybody now became an expert. Now we all become a medical expert and we are giving advices, which is good. Alhamdulillah, we are having our a lot of information, but in the same time, it's too much confusing. At this time, I started to learn more, to observe and enjoy my time with my family and mind my own business, which is really good. Alhamdulillah, it's really good. Just stay positive, stay away from the social media. Do not get exposed too much and try to enjoy the blessing that you have with the family, with the serenity time. Just try to resort again all your priorities. What is more important things for you in life?
That was Haifa Hussein, a staff member at the University of Qatar in Doha and a mother of three, speaking about the country's shelter-in-place directives. Californians have now been sheltered-in-place for a few weeks, and states across the nation have steadily been joining in with shelter-in-place directives. While the CDC says the stay-at-home orders are instrumental in curbing the pandemic, Reverend Leslie Takuhashi, the lead minister at the Mount Diablo Unitarian Universalist Church in Walnut Creek, says she is aware of the side effects of loneliness and feelings of isolation.
You know, it's like we're living in a totally different world. We have managed to turn our operation over about 2 weeks into an entirely virtual operation, including 2 worships a week, small group meetings, times virtual coffee hours 3 times a week for people to connect, lots and lots of ways that people can stay together.
How many people are showing up for virtual coffee and for some of these meetings? Kind of what's the age group, the demographic?
We've had about close to 500 people on the stream for Sunday morning, 500 households. And then we've had 20 to 40 people on the coffees and other meetings. And it's totally ranges from younger people to our oldest people who are in their 90s, who have learned how to use the technology and are connecting online.
What have some of the challenges been to support everybody in these times?
You know, I actually have to say that one of our groups is our Elder Journey group, and almost everybody's in their 80s or 90s and some 70s, but they have actually been one of our largest attending groups with 18 to 20 people on the group every week. So I think they've really been interested in learning something new, and they've been willing to do it. And some other folks, I think, aren't willing to do it, but we've got volunteers who are willing to coach each other, and we've got people that are willing to help each other. So it's been interesting to see how everybody has bonded together on that.
And talk about the steps that you've taken to go completely virtual.
You know, what we're trying to do is actually give people as many ways as possible to connect with each other. So we do several events a day, and they're all focused on different things that people might want. And so that allows people to have different ways to be high touch. And the people that do connect with us, we encourage them to connect to other people so that they can get other people involved. And so we've been trying to do as many things as we can to reach different people with different interests and different kinds of ways that they need to be supported. That includes spiritual resources, learning, and opportunities to be with other people and just say what they're afraid of and have that human touch during the day. We have a lot of people that live alone, and it's really reassuring to them to have 1 or 2 times a day they could just tune in and be with other people. And that's really critical. You know, we talk a lot about the physical threat, but the spiritual and emotional threat of this pandemic is equally dangerous for us.
Talk about that.
So I think isolation, which is something we already know going into this, we have record numbers of people in our country for several years now reporting being lonely, and now all of a sudden they're locked into this shelter in place, and so they really are feeling isolated. So it's really important for people to have a chance to be able to see other people's faces, and sometimes the first or second time people come on, they're actually, you know, brought to tears just by connecting with people. And it's a very important thing.
So loneliness and the feeling of aloneness, I think, has been very amplified for people, as you've suggested. What do you want people to think about during these times in terms of getting beyond the loneliness? What can we do to really stay connected and take care of ourselves and each other?
So I think for me, one of the things that is really helping me is just the opportunity to know that we are there and connecting to people, and being able to see people and connect with them every day is really making a difference for me. And I guess for me, that's also what people are being able to do is just to do something for themselves or for somebody else that allows them to feel a sense of possibility and a sense of connection. We have people making masks. We have people driving groceries to each other so that only a few people from each neighborhood can go. We have people who are donating to a virtual community food pantry so that we can give money to people that are out of work. So, I mean, I think those things help us feel like we're all in this together, and that makes us feel less lonely, less isolated, and less frightened.
Takahashi says that all are welcome to join Sunday's virtual services or engagement opportunities at mduuc.org. This evening, Code Pink will host an hour-long Zoom meeting at 7 p.m. to look at U.S. policy toward Venezuela. The meeting will feature Code Pink co-founders Medea Benjamin and Jody Evans, Anne Wright from Veterans for Peace, and a host of others. To learn about Code Pink's distance and virtual engagement programs and campaigns, you can visit their Code Pink COVID-19 resource page. And the weather for the San Francisco Bay Area. Rain continuing through the weekend with lows in the 50s this evening and highs in the mid-50s tomorrow. In the central San Joaquin Valley, rain continuing through the night with a low of 48 this evening and highs of around 60 for tomorrow. That's it for this evening's newscast. Thanks to David Rosenberg for helping to prepare tonight's news and to Carla West, who's at the controls. And thanks to the listeners for tuning in. Remember to stay home and stay safe. I'm Sharon Sabota. Good evening.